Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, and our special guest this week, the president of the Marketing Resource Group, Tom Shields. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Nice being back.
And Tom, I'm sorry to say I did not win the Marketing Resource Final Four bracket this year. I won 2 years ago, but this year, after the Sweet 16, my bracket just went right down the porcelain.
Yeah, we had about 80% of the people either picking Duke or MSU in this one. So, you know, I think we only have five people still in the poll who have Virginia. Nobody has Texas Tech. So if Texas Tech wins tonight, you know, it's just those who did well back in round 16 and round 2 and round 1, you know, are going to be the winners here. But, you know, every once in a while that happens. This was a year actually most of the favorites won up until the last games. But Texas Tech looks like they're the hot team right now. I'll go with them if I had a chance to bet again.
You won't get another chance. You get a lot of participation in that pool. What, you had like 50 people, something like that, who participated?
Yeah, we've had between 50 and 75 every year get in for that. And, you know, it's really interesting. It's a good combination of various types of folks who get in, and everybody has fun. I have never won a dime. I think that's about 20 years I've been running this thing. I have never finished in the top three ever to win a dime in this thing. So I know we can accuse of doing this to pad my own pockets, that's for sure.
John's laughing over here because John's won the MERS pool a few times.
I have won it once, I think.
Just once,
just
okay.
Once, yeah.
Jack almost won it this year, but then your Gonzaga Bulldogs got beat by the same Texas Tech team.
Yeah, I should have known better. I mean, you got a neat name like Gonzaga, but they have a boring nickname like Bulldogs. So that right there, I should have thought that over.
You should have thought Red Raiders. I mean, how can you be more cool than Red Raiders?
Hey, remember I did tell you when I filled it out that I had Michigan beating Texas Tech. That was when I went, I just have a funny feeling that was a mistake, and it had no logic involved. But sometimes your instincts are what you should follow.
Yeah, and to think that the Red Raiders beat your Michigan Wolverines, and they broke the heart of your pick, Gonzaga, and now they beat Michigan State.
Well, when was the last time a team, and I believe it's the only time a team from Texas ever won the NCAA tournament?
Was it Texas Wesleyan?
Texas Western, now Texas El Paso, the famous one that came out of nowhere.
That's right. They beat Kentucky in the championship, right?
Yep. They came out of nowhere. The fellow, I think the coach's name was Haskins, if I remember. And he went there, and he had been a girls' basketball coach before being grabbed there. They were not even known as a basketball school. And he looked around, and nobody wanted to go there. And he thought, hey, there are better players in the inner cities back in the East, in Detroit and in New York, et cetera. So he went, and he got these inner-city kids to play, and suddenly, Texas Western is a power.
I still have the Sports Illustrated cover with them on it winning the national championship that I saved from that period
of time.
Right? Yeah, just an amazing story about, you know, these inner city kids who came together from all different places to play in Little Texas Western, and you know, and beat powerful Kentucky.
Well, according to the movie, he kind of exaggerated how beautiful El Paso was to some of these kids' families, et cetera. So,
oh, I don't know. I think El Paso is all pretty nice, unless you want to look over the border. And the sister city to El Paso is not very nice. It looks pretty.
You mean Warsaw? I mean, not Warsaw, Juarez?
Juarez, yeah. Yeah, Juarez isn't. Yeah.
Well, I remember going over there when I was 19 in the afternoon with a couple of friends, and it was 2 cents to cross the bridge. You went, there's a turnstile across the bridge, and I had to borrow 2 cents to come back.
Oh, man.
And I remember getting Casablanca beer, which was something like 20 cents. You know, to have a bottle of Casablanca beer until you'd been there a while. And it ended up getting up to like 80 cents a bottle the longer he sat there drinking it. So I assume it's probably hasn't changed too much since then.
Texas Tech tonight, we'll see how they do against Virginia. But let's talk about some Michigan issues. And one of the stories that was forwarded to me last week that I ended up reading on a spring break that I enjoyed was about President Trump still having some problems with his appointments as it relates to Michigan. This story from NBC News talks about several Trump ambassador nominees who gave to his inaugural committee that have still not gotten the blessing of the Senate, one of them being John Ricolta, who gave $250,000 and has still not been confirmed as ambassador of the United Arab Emirates, and David Fisher, who donated also $250,000, has still not been confirmed as ambassador to Morocco. Now, according to this story, they quote a Marquette University professor who apparently looks into ambassador appointments. I guess if you got to have a niche, this is this guy's niche. This is his thing. And he says that Trump has been basically 50-50 as far as his ambassador choices, half of them being folks who have contributed to his campaign or been just generous givers in general, and the other half being people who are actually foreign emissaries as a profession. And this is a larger percentage than most presidents, allegedly.
Does he say what Obama was? I mean, is it up from 45 to 55 or something like that?
I think this has been pretty consistent through most presidencies, is that you have the professional emissaries who basically do this for a living, and you put those probably in the countries that you have to, you know, have to have those good relationships with. Otherwise, you know, we have potential political problems. And the other ones, I think, go to political supporters, and that's always been historically what's happened out here. I mean, I think of Pete Secchia, who was, you know, appointed to Italy, which, so surprisingly, you know, it was a pretty good spot. But you know, they loved Pete in Italy. I mean, he had a great, and he did a wonderful job. You know, he good people like David Fisher, you know, they're good people. They know what they're doing. They're smart. They'll do a good job of it. It's just a shame that the government has broken down to this point that you can't get ambassadorships approved. I mean, there's nothing controversial about ambassadors. That's just, you know, punitive measures by the, you know, by the Senate against the president here. And it's really just a shame, because really that's what brings gridlock here. And I think that's what hurts the whole process, because now all of a sudden, you know, why should Trump then, you know, bust his tail trying to fill these spots if the Senate's not going to do anything about it? Just another fight, just another delay. It's just really a shame.
You can get into a lot of trouble in Morocco, though.
Yeah, I tell you, I think Fisher got the better draw there with Morocco over the United Arab Emirates.
That's a plum assignment. I'd take that job.
Well, what's the qualification in some of these, you know, most of the countries out there? For years and years and decades, these have been kind of political rewards in these other countries. It just keep in touch, let us know what's going on there, and don't say anything or do anything stupid. I mean, what else is the qualification? You probably have to dress nice and go to all these functions, but I don't know. I don't know if you need to really have this great pedigree in terms of international knowledge to fill these positions.
Well, and it's not like they're out there on their own representing the United States. They have staff. They have trained professionals that give them background papers and brief them on who the local luminaries are that they have to meet with. It's not like this guy's going to be walking in out of the cold and hey, I'm here to represent the U.S. to Morocco. What's Morocco, you know?
And these offices are still running. I mean, they're running without an ambassador, you know, being approved by the U.S. Senate here. They're still running today, and they're run by professional bureaucrats who do this. And, you know, and that's what those offices do. You're right. What kind of, just don't make any mistakes. Don't stick your foot in it. Don't create any incidents. You know, be a good ambassador and then do your time and come home. And then that staff will stay there for the next ambassador.
So in speaking about appointments, now Trump still has vacancies for the U.S. attorney position here in the state of Michigan, the Western District, and two federal marshal positions. He just recently made appointments to the U.S. District Court with Michael Bogren from the Western District and Stephanie Dawkins Davis from the Eastern District. Those appointments filled vacancies that date back to October of 2016. And this kind of goes back to your point, Tom, about what does this say about the system that we still have these kind of vacancies out there? And who knows how long it's going to take these two judges to get confirmed. But we have these things just open for years now. And it's like common operating procedure.
And the problem is you get retaliation for the next administration. So when Trump, yes, when Trump is gone, say you get a Democrat or the next one in, then you're going to get paybacks. And so they're going to do the exact same thing. This is a system that just doesn't work. It makes no sense at all to have these petty arguments between the two political parties when it comes to administrative stuff. These are kind of things that usually, I mean, the Republicans are like, but they approved the Obama folks. You know, last year, obviously, they had some problems with the judicial stuff, but for the most part, they approved all their people that went through. Before that, the Democrats approved things that were made by Bush. So, you know, it is just it's a shame that it's gotten to this point. And then I think what it does is it does not behoove the Trump administration to go out of their way then to start finding people here, just starting another battle. And it's a shame when we waited until 2016 to fill those judgeships. I mean, that's those were waiting to be filled. There was people who would gladly have gone on them. From the Republican side, I think a couple of folks were hoping that some Republicans, local or state judges would have gotten appointed to those and would have gave Snyder those appointments. That didn't happen.
Like Brian Zara. Like, why didn't Zara get one of those appointments? And then you open up that vacancy and Snyder could have made the appointment to replace Zara, who he appointed to that position.
And that's what I'm surprised. And again, some of that, it probably comes from the fact that Snyder didn't have necessarily a great working relationship with Trump, so it couldn't actually push him to make that appointment. And again, that's where you get the breakdown here. And I think everybody thought Brian Zara was going to get one of those spots. And then the governor then would get an appointment to the Supreme Court. So, his spot being up, that person runs with incumbency designation, which is the way the system usually works here. But it's broken down, and somebody needs to just stop and say enough of the stuff. Let's just fix this, get these appointments approved, let government run so we don't have this gridlock, at least on the appointment process, and move on to more important things.
And speaking of that, looking back historically, and I know my frame of reference isn't as long as yours, Tom, but looking back at the Obama administration, we had those games going to George W. Bush. We had those games. It just seems like it's a never-ending cycle, and it is very unfortunate that we see that at the federal level. Staying on the federal subject here, I received an email last week while I was on vacation from a Michael. And I'm not familiar with Michael, but he was commenting on a story that MERS did for the City Pulse. We provide a story for the City Pulse every week. And one of the stories that I did was, remember the Punchki Day, John? You were at the Punchki event with me, with the Trescott-Rossman Punchki event there at Tropo. So my assignment on that day was I was going to talk to as many people as I could to see if they were supporting anyone for the Democratic nomination for president or if they had any thoughts about it, what have you. I spoke with Sharon Emery over at Trescott-Rossman. She does still some work over there. And she had made the observation that Elizabeth Warren, maybe her time has passed, that maybe she should have run in 2016 as opposed to now where she seems to be getting overshadowed. Well, Michael wrote, "Yes, I know it's only deadline journalism, and for the Pulse at that. But when you throw in a quote from, quote, veteran journalist and PR professional Sharon Emery that attempts to persuade us that Liz Warren, quote, missed her time, at least some of your readers are going to notice that that's stupid at best. Has too much time with Tim Skubick brought you down to his level? That is not a good thing." So anyway, so then my response was, I appreciate the note, but based on what I'm seeing, Warren in the high single digits, despite her high name ID, I'm inclined to agree with Sharon. I'm feeling more enthusiasm for Harris, O'Rourke, and Mayor Pete than Elizabeth Warren. Warren should have run in 2016 when an entitled Hillary Clinton lulled the Dems into boredom, and the only alternative was Bernie. Now we are seeing everyone who should have run in 16, Biden, Booker, Warren, try to make up for lost time. What are you seeing to persuade me otherwise? Are you guys seeing anything to persuade me otherwise on this?
Oh, I'll persuade you otherwise, although it's meaningless. But I remember somebody was absolutely a has-been, had missed his opportunity, and that was McCain, remember?
Well, this is in the Republicans now. The Republicans are different.
In 2008, I mean, it was over. He was out of money, everything else, and boom, he started suddenly winning primaries and coming out of nowhere. And he had missed his time, but it ended up being his time that year until it got to the general election, that is.
All right, but that's Republicans now. If this was a Republican debate, I might actually agree with Michael here. But Democrats don't operate.
With many candidates that are in this thing, how do you know that climbing up to maybe 9% won't be enough?
I guess if you're splitting it up among 20 people, right?
I think Michael is proof positive why partisans shouldn't be pundits. I think he's looking through some Liz-colored glasses here.
I think timing is everything in politics, and you've got to catch the the wind when it's blowing in your direction here. And I think I may not be bad. I think Sharon Emery may be actually right. I think maybe it's past time here for Elizabeth Warren. I don't think she's necessarily catching that same kind of support that she was catching before. I think that the wing of the party that she represents, which is, you know, the far left wing of that party, I think is split up between a whole lot of folks that are probably a little bit more popular and a little bit hotter right now than what she is. And I think the new fresh talent is where the young people are going in the Democratic Party, and I think they're the ones who are going to control who's a nominee this time.
It's also, I think, a frustration of federal officials. I mean, we talked about it already, the dysfunction in Washington, D.C., and you know, I mean, she's a member of the Senate, the dysfunctional Senate. So I'm not surprised that, you know, Mayor Pete's, I think, is outpolling her. He's an outsider. He's a different commodity. He's a different era. And I think people want something that's not Washington, D.C.
And, you know, maybe this is still early, right? And we're still getting on to the flavor of the month. And right now it happens to be Mayor Pete. And maybe next month it will be somebody else. And maybe Kamala Harris comes up. And maybe Elizabeth Warren does catch on. But all I know is that Beto O'Rourke outraised everybody when he came on the scene. He outraised Bernie. He raised $1 million, $2 million. Mayor Pete's hot right now. Elizabeth Warren came out, announced that she was running for president, and all I heard was a collective yawn. Yep. It's like,
but they're both, think about both those candidates. They're younger. They're a newer generation than Elizabeth Warren and the rest of them.
Anyway, so my point on this is Elizabeth Warren in 2016, she seemed to be that fresh. She seemed to actually bring energy back then to a race, and then she decided not to. And I think you're right, Tom. I think timing is everything, and she had an opportunity. And I don't know, I know you're pretty skeptical on this, Jack, that you think that the Clintons were going to win no matter what because they basically paid off the Democrats' debt. And maybe that is true, but it seemed like she was actually bringing some energy that could have appealed to more establishment Democrats than Bernie ended up doing.
She would have had to catch on really early to do that because the way the Democratic, you know, process is set up, I mean, so much goes these superdelegates who control the Democratic Party, who controls the process. So I think she would have had to catch on really early and taken Hillary out of the race, the only way she was ever going to get that nomination. She wasn't going to get it one-on-one with Hillary. Hillary would have had to fail and falter early on in order to do that. But again, she was a sort of fresh new candidate out of the box in 2016. She should have done that. You know, Democratic Party should have done anybody but Hillary, and they would have won.
Michael, thanks for giving us the sending me the email and giving us some discussion to talk about on the last podcast of spring break here. Then one other thing I wanted to bring up before we talk to Tom about Tigers baseball. Rich Baird gives Tim Skubick an interview on Off the Record in which he insults his own host, which I don't know how you do this in journalism, but he tells Tim Skubick that unless it was in the Wall Street Journal, he paid very little attention to state capital coverage. And then he says, it was very difficult to find both intelligent and balanced journalists, adding that reporters seemed to write the story before they covered it, and therefore, quote, it was not worth my time to read. So here, Tim Skubick clears the panel for him. You know, he doesn't have the three reporter panel. It's just him and Rich Baird, gives the guy the half hour show. And then Rich Baird thanks him by insulting him on his own show. I mean, what kind of gall is that?
I don't know. You don't go to someone's house and piss in their living room. I mean, this is what he did to Skubick. I think there's a reason why, you know, Baird wore a lot of different hats in the Snyder administration, but none of them were communications director.
I think four words come to mind: homestead exemption and skunk works.
Here's what came to my mind. So Rich Baird, from what I remember, when the journalists actually got to him, gave him glowing coverage. The business reporter, what was that, Tom Walsh, I think, did a column on him that was very, very glowing. The media had worked up this reputation of Rich Baird that he was like the godfather behind the scene that made things happen. Chad Livingood from Cranes just did a story on him a few weeks ago that I thought was very nice, very complete, kind of talked about his role in the administration. I thought was very glowing, and I thought complimentary in general. The only time Rich Baird got into the news was when he put himself in the news by first of all failing to realize that you can't claim a homestead exemption on two homes, and then bullying the clerk out in DeWitt Township into thinking it was her fault that he filled his own forms out wrong or whatever. and then blames everybody else except himself on it. And then he comes back and says that he can't really find any intelligent journalists. I mean, we're not the ones who didn't fill out his homestead exemption forms.
I'm trying to figure what I've missed as far as the unexpected, totally uniquely independent articles in the Wall Street Journal. Maybe he was actually reading the stock pages. That would be unexpected a lot of times. But I just don't know if I see that much difference in terms of national or state-oriented coverage of things. I don't think one or if anything, I tend to think the more local you get, the better the coverage is, and the less it is all people agreeing to the narrative to begin with.
You know, I'm not denying that Rich Barrett had an integral part in this last administration. He probably did some great things. I hear high praise for his work with the Detroit bankruptcy and so forth. I don't understand why he's got to insult journalists on the way out the door, though. I thought the coverage on him was quite fair, to be perfectly honest.
And I think it was too. And I think he made it very clear he didn't want to be in the public limelight. And I thought the press respected that. You know, they did not necessarily go and waiting outside his door and figuring out what he was doing in Flint while he was living there and what he was doing in Detroit bankruptcy. I think they basically understood that and went to the people who would talk to them. And I thought that was he got more than fair treatment. And I agree, the article that was done on him was very favorable and put him in a great limelight. Sort of left him after administration as the guy behind the scenes who made things work, you know, it's a great place to be. And now he throws this thing. It's just, it's really too bad. But obviously, it's a guy who's not planning on doing a whole lot of work in public service after this.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. So Tom, you were at, we'll kind of close things out here. You were doing opening day again for the Ilitches. And how did opening day go?
Opening day was great, except for 43 degrees and
it wasn't snowing at Comerica.
It did not snow. There was an initial prediction of snow for the day, but it was never. It never got warm. I don't think the stands ever half filled, except for the national anthem, and the certainly wasn't the opening pitch. But you know, everybody was ducking somewhere where they could get warm. But it was great. Tigers won. They're in first place in American League Central. All is good in Detroit. Everybody should come down to the ballpark and watch these young guys play. They can't hit, but the pitching's is wonderful.
Well, when it's 45 degrees, nobody wants to make contact with the ball, so they'll just let it go right into the catcher's mitt.
That's true. I was looking for guys on my fantasy team the other day, and I couldn't believe how many folks that I found are outfielders that were batting 61 or 122. And I'm trying to search for somebody who was batting in the 200s just to take them.
Well, I did find a Tiger to take in one of my fantasy leagues, so I do have a Tiger this year, Nico Goodrum. And the reason I took Nico is because he qualifies for about every position on the field, so I can just insert him whenever somebody has a bye or somebody's injured.
Every team needs one of those guys.
Every fantasy team
needs one of those guys, because then he can just fill in those days where you have or on the days off and put him wherever you want to. I have one of those on my team, too. I can't remember his name, but I've got one. I was just looking for one with multiple places.
Nico Goodrum. Do you have a Tiger this year, John?
I don't.
I know Jack doesn't follow it, but who is your favorite Tiger of all time?
It would still probably have to be Al Kaline. I mean, I went to a couple games back when in the day in the late 60s, and I can still remember being in the box seats on the first base side and watching him throw it on a line from right field all the way into home plate. You never saw anything like that from your average players.
Like nobody else could.
Nobody else could. My favorite always was Ben Willie Horton. He was a Detroit guy, came up through the Detroit City school system, was the only kid in the high school to hit a home run at Tiger Stadium when he played there for the city championship. Picked right out of high school to play for the Tigers and played for his entire career until the end. And we went to play in Seattle a little bit.
And one of the things forgotten sometimes, I think, about Willie Horton was he wasn't known as a great outfielder. He was adequate, but he's the one who threw out Lou Brock in the World Series in the pivotal fifth game.
That 68 World Series when Lou Brock thought he didn't have to slide and nobody expected Willie Horton to throw anybody out, especially not Lou Brock. And he pegs one home, you know, and threw his arm off probably. And changed the World Series. It really did. 68 World Series, you know, and plus all Willie has done for the city. I've been lucky to spend some time with Willie Horton, and and he's sort of been an ambassador for the team. Mr. Ilitch wanted to do that for him, and, you know, bring him in the team and have the ambassador. And he's almost at every single game, watching everything, down in the press box, talking to people. But a wonderful, wonderful, delightful person to have. And he cares about that city. He still lives in the same neighborhood that he did when he grew up.
Obviously, a change in ownership structure here with the passing of Mr. I. What's it been like working with Chris now and Ilitch Holdings since then?
You know, Mr. I, in his last few years, focused on sports teams while Chris was taking over the rest of the businesses. And that really allowed him to do that. And again, he was like a kid in a candy shop. He could tell you, you know, what kids in the minors were batting that they had.
Mike,
who was coming up? Oh, yeah, Mike could. He followed this, and he knew it. He knew the stats. He knew, you know, he didn't go down and try to manage the team. He wasn't talking to Sparky or anybody else telling him what to do. But he could talk baseball, and he understood and watched what was going on. When trades were made, you know, they obviously got approved by him, and he knew what was going on. And Chris is a little bit different kind of guy, but he's still a baseball guy. Chris still played fast-pitch baseball up until a couple years ago. So he's also a baseball player. Also plays hockey too, and I think he still plays hockey. They're both, you know, like Mike Ilitch. He's a sports fanatic. He's also a fan, and I think it's different than when Mike was there. But I think it's the same kind of tradition that keeps on with Chris Ilitch, and that he's a fan of the Tigers. I think before he's an owner.
So do you think if I have you on in a month that the Tigers are still going to be in first place?
If they can get up to 225 under his hand and keep this pitching going, who knows what can happen? You know, this young guys. I mean, again, division's not that strong. When be picked. I mean, the odds are against it. I mean, everybody was picking to finish towards the bottom this year. And I think this is, this is where they, you know, in their rebuilding plan, you know, the year I think they were the bottom out. I think they were looking at, but they're adding some good young talent. They've got great drafts. These pitchers are actually, you know, coming on and pitching, doing well. They just need to draft some hitters, as far as I'm concerned.
I think you'd have a better shot in 3 weeks, not a full month.
Just 3 weeks? If we have them on in 3 weeks, how about next week? Will the Tigers still be in first place?
Well, they very well could be. They very well could be. I mean, there's all kinds of teams. If you look back at who had got off the great starts, it's quite often has very little to do with how the standings end up. But, yeah, 3 weeks they might still be hanging on there.
If they were in the American League East, I don't think that would be the case. But the American League Central with Kansas City and Chicago, they're not very good.
Boston is tubing it. They beat the Yankees 2 out of 3. I mean, hell, we clean up on American League East.
Oh, and you're not paid to say that either, of course not.
Well, let's play all the games with the temperature 43.
There you go. That's what we need. That's what we need.
Nobody hits at 43 degrees. Nobody wants that sting of that bat, when much less catch the ball, but nobody wants the sting of the bat either. I mean, nobody wants to swing and connect that ball. That just hurts.
All right. Tom Shields from the Marketing Resource Group, thanks for coming over. And Jack and John, and also thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.